I got this new song for y'all about the quadratic formula.
Ooh.
All you need is a quadratic equation to be ready to solve the root.
X equals n is O, negative b, that's a mod, the square root of b squared minus 4ac for sure, now find a root over 2.
That's a soon-to-be NASA engineer from Missouri rapping about the quadratic formula. I love it so much. Deja Mo Williams is on the line with us now from Missouri S&T in Rolla to talk about math, science, rapping, and her new gig at NASA. Deja, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How about you?
I'm doing very well.
We are going to get your story in just a second, but can you please remind me what the deal is with the quadratic formula? I do remember memorizing it, but I don't remember why.
Well, I just remember my sophomore year of high school, and pre-calc is a very important formula to find where the curve actually crossed the x-axis, and this was the equation that you used. And my teacher, she challenged us to make a song for it, and she used like Pop Goes the Weasel, and I wanted to put some flavor, my own culture, into it, so I used the Soulja Boy song, and that's where it stemmed from.
Can you tell me a little bit about your own background, how you got into math, et cetera?
Okay. So I was able to go to this school called, a community called Kirkwood High School. And
that's in St. Louis?
They had some, yes, in St. Louis, Missouri. They had some Project Lead the Way classes, which are engineering classes. In conjunction with that, I was actually this a part of a program called the YES Team, which was Youth Exploring Science at the St. Louis Science Center. And they taught me some math and science topics. And through Project Lead the Way and the Science Center is where I gained my appreciation for math and science, I would say.
When you say that you were able to attend this school, what do you mean by that?
So they had this program called the VIC program. I'm not exactly sure what the acronym stands for, but it allowed city students in the St. Louis City area to go to county schools, which, you know, usually have a better education than some St. Louis public schools.
What was that was that a positive experience for you?
It ended up being a positive experience for me. Initially, it was really tough. I went into these classes not knowing exactly what to do, where I fit in. No one necessarily looked like me. And there was no help, as in the teachers didn't know the struggle that I was going through. I had to wake up extra early to go on a 30-minute bus ride, whereas some of the students that lived in the community of Kirkwood were able to walk to school. Their parents were able to bring them their homework if they forgot it, and some of their parents were engineers or teachers and things of that sort. So it was a total different culture than I was used to, and it was pretty difficult to get acclimated to it.
When did things start turning around and feeling more like, okay, I've got the hang of this, or there's something here for me?
Absolutely. My seventh grade year, I'm not sure what type of math we were learning, probably algebra. And I got my first 100 on my test. It was just one night. I was just like, let me just figure this out. I'm tired of getting bad grades. I'm tired of, you know, when you get the test passed back and everyone asks, so what'd you get? What'd you get? And I was always embarrassed to say what I got. So I put a couple more hours into my study and got my first 100. And man, that feeling was so exhilarating that I started to take it a lot more serious in all of my topics, but primarily my math and science topics, because a lot of the African-American students weren't prevailing in those subjects. And, you know, I wanted to help others as well. So I put the team on my back, I would say, and started learning this material so that I could learn it for myself and help others as well.
The word exhilarating isn't something that comes up a lot when you talk about math class with people and their memories of math class. Can you describe a little more just how exhilaration became part of your experience with math?
Okay. It would always be that day that you got the test back, that feeling of seeing an A, a 90 on your test or a 90 to 100. And the way my mom responded to me getting good grades, being good at math wasn't something that was typically, you know, normal in my family. So this was something that was surprising to them. So they were encouraging me and just having that family support and just, oh man, I can't even explain what it feels like to get good grades when people wouldn't normally expect you to.
When you say that you started putting the team on your back when you were pursuing these, when you were excelling in math, can you explain what you mean by that?
Okay, what I mean by that is I would, you know, start to build relationships with other students in the classroom. Actually, I would say white students in the classroom who had more knowledge about these subjects, building that relationship and learning little tricks of the trade, I would say, which is, you know, of math and science, and sharing that with my peers who were coming from the city schools and things of that sort. They weren't necessarily as comfortable with networking with other students that didn't come from the same background. So, you know, I would be that caveat between the two groups.
Like tricks of the trade that, can you give me an example?
For example, the quadratic formula, learning this through a song, I actually got this assignment assigned to me because I was in an honors pre-algebra classroom, and a lot of my counterparts from the city of St. Louis, they weren't in the honors class, so they didn't have the opportunity to learn something that was difficult through music. So I would share this song with them as well so that they could, you know, learn the quadratic formula as well as I would. That would be an example, very prevalent.
As you moved up through the academic system from high school into college, going to a science and technology school there in Rolla, how has race factored into that journey?
Wow, it's been very difficult. On any given day, you can go to class, you look to your left, you look to your right, and no one looks like you. There's about maybe one or two, maybe three in your classrooms, especially as you get up into your upper level classes. And it just makes it really difficult to bond and get study groups. The study groups are something that really helps in difficult subjects. And if you don't have anyone who understands you, or you guys don't have the same inside jokes, it's really difficult to learn. Although that is a social aspect of school. And learning is the most important piece. It's important to have friends in your classroom that you can actually grind with and get this work done. And a lot of Black students here at Missouri S&T don't have that opportunity, but we're looking to change that.
Does it frustrate you that you have to address race even when you're dealing with something as abstract as the quadratic equation?
I would say yes. This is not on... Let's say some of the top academic scholars, they don't have to think about this. So they're just learning the material and excelling, whereas someone that is African-American have to learn this material, excel, but also think about, okay, how do I fit in? How do I get on the teacher's side and get them to teach me how I need to be taught? A lot of times, say we have a math problem and the math problem has nothing to do with our culture. It's talking about maybe like farming or skiing or something like that. These are opportunities that we don't necessarily have. And so we can't understand the math problem because it's written in words that we don't typically hear growing up.
You know, in the video for this quadratic formula rap, the very beginning of it, there's a white guy teaching the class, and the classroom full of students is kind of looking a little not 100% engaged, and you're sitting there, you've got your button-up shirt and your glasses on and a tie, and you raise your hand and step up and kind of say, like, no, there's a better way to do this. That's how that video starts. And there's some commentary, I assume you've looked at the comments, and there's some commentary about, is this setting a bad example, that the student's getting up and taking over the class and maybe not respecting the teacher? But from what you just said, I feel like there's another message there that you intended.
Yes, there is another message that there are multiple ways to teach different topics. And also, that scene was in there not to down any math professor. It was basically showing a parody to be a little bit funny, and also showing that this is a supplementary tool to the teacher. This is not saying teachers don't teach well enough, but here's another way that can touch another demographic that hasn't been tapped into.
Or just a student speaking up and saying, this isn't what reaches me.
Exactly.
You know, we've talked about your passion for math, but what about the music piece of it? I know you are primarily an engineer, not a rapper, but you very obviously have some kind of musical background.
Absolutely. My love for music started very young. My family always has talent shows at our family reunions, and we actually had a professional artist. His name was Pretty Russ. Rest in peace, Pretty Russ. But he used to write a lot of raps for me whenever we did our talent shows. Me and my cousins, Tanel and Dave, we would perform maybe like Nelly songs and things of that sort. And that's where I gained from my love for music. Also, I started playing clarinet in fourth grade, to where I learned to read music. And also that led me into being in marching band in high school. And man, was that some of the best years of my life. I loved getting on the field, doing the formations, playing the popular songs, just getting the crowd to be excited during the football game. That was, you know, a super exciting experience. I loved putting a uniform on. I loved during the parades, marching, and my family taking pictures. It was, oh man, I just loved it.
So now you're getting the crowd excited in math class.
Exactly.
Were you pursuing music all along as you've been pursuing math and science and engineering, or is it something that you had to put aside and then got to pick back up with this quadratic equation song?
So I did have to put it aside, unfortunately. My sophomore year of high school, my mom sat me down and asked me, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? I told her I wanted to be a high school band director. And even now, people say, what do you want to do? And I say, if money did not matter, I would be a high school band director. But she told me, you know, maybe do something a little more conventional, build your foundation, get financially stable, and then pursue your music. So, you know, I listened to my mom. She's, you know, been in the world a little bit more than I have, so she knows more. And I got into those Project Lead the Way classes that I spoke of earlier, and I ended up loving the engineering, and it took me away from the music. However, once I interned at Apple, couple years down the road, I was able to get a hold of Logic Pro 10. And as I was learning this material, so many hours had went by, and it just reminded me of how much I missed music and how much I loved it. So I started to take it a little more serious. I was slow getting into it, but I just started producing songs, releasing them, you know, no matter how good I thought they were. I just wanted to share my art and see what people thought of it. And
so an internship at Apple, as an engineering internship at Apple, got you kind of combining your interests?
Exactly. At Apple, it allowed me to see that I can mix the two. They have Apple Music, and they create a bunch of software for audio music production. And it made me realize, like, everything literally goes back to science, technology, engineering, and math. So I can match my purpose and my passion, which is engineering and music. So from that moment, I was determined to find a way to create a career for myself where I could mix the two.
Do you think that you'll continue to rap about math? I mean, I'm guessing you're going to be pretty busy coming up with your new job at NASA.
Absolutely. Yes, I am going to use all of my free time to create more raps that these students can learn from. And I'm actually looking to recruit students to help me create these songs, because it is for them. So if I don't have them in the planning process or helping me create these songs, how can I ensure that it'll help them? So, you know, once I get off work, I'm going to start writing or go to after school programs and try to get more songs, whether that be Apple Music, Spotify, Pandora. I want this to be a legit movement, teaching through music.
Speaking of this job at NASA, what are you going to be doing?
So I'll be a manufacturing engineer, and that basically deals with the fabrication of the unique parts that goes on spacecraft, such as the Mars 2020 rover that's coming up. You got the Europa lander and things of that sort.
Okay, that is amazing. I've never before
excited.
Met someone who builds spaceships. It's basically what you're talking about. Did you see the movie Hidden Figures about the African-American women who worked as human computers for NASA in the early 60s?
Yes, I seen the movie. And before I seen the movie, NASA was not on my radar. It didn't dawn on me like, hey, you can go work at NASA. It just was this untouchable thing. And I seen the movie and I was just like, wow, it's so amazing. It actually made me cry because I could relate so much to what they were going through. Although, you know, their situation was worse than mine, because, you know, we have advanced a little bit. It was just, wow, we are still dealing with some of the same issues. And
what
even
was
after
it
the movie,
that was there a moment that especially like hit home for you?
The moment, it was when Taraji P. Henson, she was working a little bit harder than everyone in the room. And it just reminded me back to when I was in high school and I had to, you know, wake up a lot earlier, study later than most people. It just reminded me that I have to work a little bit harder to get some of the same things that my white male counterparts can. And also the scene where she had to go super far to the bathroom. That just, you know, really touched home. It was just really sad and showed that, you know, I have to go over a little bit more hurdles than most people do to get to the top.
It sounds like it reminds me maybe a little of what you were talking about before with your extra long commute from home to school.
Yep.
I mean, is that history of these women that has come to light in recent years? Is that something you feel as you head off to pursue this huge opportunity?
It's off and on. Sometimes I do feel it, but NASA has created a community where I do feel involved. There are, you know, little stragglers who do make me feel inferior and, you know, make me prove my worth a little bit more or try to question me or make me look bad. But for the most part, there are people who are really supporting me and want to see me do well. So,
well, Deja Mo Williams, graduating senior at Missouri S&T, thanks for talking to us today and congratulations on your new job.
Absolutely. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Deja's rap video about the quadratic formula is on Missouri S&T's YouTube channel. We'll link to it with this show later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we've got more show coming up, so don't go away. When you think of Kansas City smells, what comes to mind? Is it a location?
Stockyards. Down in the bottoms, the original stockyards down there, that's what I think of when I think of Kansas City smells.
Or something tasty?
Barbecue. Barbecue in general. Gates.
But while some smells whet your appetite, others do not.
Going across the bridge between Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas, sometimes that smell over there is not too pleasant.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we're exploring the smells of Kansas City, good and bad, past and present. We want to hear about particular places that smell like home to you at 816-235-2888. I want to just say, I was inspired by a woman tweeting about the smell she remembered from the Wonder Bread Bakery driving down Troost years ago. That's not one I personally remember, but I do recall the collective despair people felt when the Folgers plant closed. We've got tons of coffee shops that roast their own beans nowadays, but people still miss that Folgers smell because it used to be like the signature scent of downtown Kansas City. Here to talk about what smell has to do with the experience of a place is Jill McKeever. She makes fragrances for a perfume line called Four Strange Women. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
What does smell have to do with our experience of a place?
Well, it goes into our minds and gives us a like a imprint in our memory. So we always travel back to that time every time we smell that again in the future. And it's very hard to break that connection.
So if you go to a place and it repeatedly smells like something, then the connection would get even stronger, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So talk to me about the smell of Kansas City. I mean, to talk about a city's smell on the whole seems almost impossible because smells change even just from storefront to storefront and block to block. But so maybe it's more of a tapestry of smell than anything else.
It is, and I think it's different for every individual because we all have our own patterns and places that we go on, you know, our regular routines. And so I think, you know, while we have some shared experiences, some people have very different experiences. But I know the things that stand out to me most when I think of scents that are just always have been in Kansas City my whole life. And it's
tell me about them.
Okay, well, I haven't been there in a long time, but growing up, Worlds of Fun was a funky place of scent.
Oh, okay. Talk about the smells you remember from Worlds of Fun. I have a few too.
Well, I've been to a lot of amusement parks, but Worlds of Fun, it like is hands down the weirdest smelling place. It has this like mildewy water scent everywhere, and then it has like the asphalt.
Yeah, the asphalt. That's the one I remember.
A very
the hot
strong
asphalt.
Asphalt scent, and it never goes away. You know, it's always like it's new asphalt. And then there's like, you know, like badly fried food, and then like a motion sickness kind of smell, like a big mixture of it all. And in a way, it's like, well, that sounds horrible. But in another way, it's like, you know, but that's
the smell of fun.
That's the smell of fun for a lot of people and their childhood. And, you know, and like going back to that might actually bring up pleasant memories. So
I also remember the smell of those brightly colored plastic animal shaped juices.
Yeah.
Do you remember those when you would open the lid? There was a smell like just sugar water smell or something.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of that like really interesting scents that I think take me back about Worlds of Fun.
Okay. What are some other ones?
You know, I lived in the Volcker neighborhood for a while, and I feel like it wouldn't be the same without Frickin' Frack blowing its vents all over the street, because although it's a very strong fried food smell, it's just been there for so long that it almost serves a comforting purpose. You know, like if I were to walk down 39th and Genesee now and that smell wasn't there, I'd be like, something is seriously wrong with this neighborhood.
Well, that brings me to a question, which is of the five senses, I feel like smell is kind of like the warning sense because it tells us about things that are invisible and out of reach. So like once you're touching something dangerous, it's too late to turn back.
Mm-hmm.
And your nose might warn you about like gas fumes that you can't see or a fire off in the distance before you are hot. So along those lines, what are some of the bad smells you've noticed that are interesting as like warnings or alarms, you know?
A lot of it is, it's more like if, like I was saying, if something that you're used to being there and that you kind of feel a sense of security and comfort because like it smells like this here and it smells like this here, if that goes away, then you just go, the neighborhood's changing, you know, or like something can give you a sense of instability just based on it being taken away after it was there for so many years. I can't think of a lot of scents that indicate danger to me in Kansas City.
You know, there's we've gotten some commentary both when our producer went out to talk to people. That's what we heard before this, what people just out on the street in Kansas City had to say about smells. From them and from my own little pokes on social media, I'm hearing a lot about river smells and then people theorizing about like when you cross the river on this or that highway, you smell this horrible smell. And what is it? And then a lot of different people have theories about why it smells a certain way at a certain crossing point of the river. And I guess I was kind of thinking about that, but I'm going to go ahead and turn now to Nicholas Bach, who is with us as well. He's an architect who, if I may say, nerds out on city planning and urban history. And I want to turn to him because, Nicholas, does the design of our city enhance certain smells?
And thanks for having me, Gina. Yes, it absolutely does. Certain smells, maybe the warning smells, are a little more, I would say, prevalent in river valleys. And the fact that our city was originally built around railroads and a lot of industry, there's a lot of leftover industry in those areas.
So like chemical-y type smells
Exactly. I think somebody mentioned smell on 435 when you cross the river. And what I've heard is that it's actually like a sulfur distilling pond or something, which I don't know what that means necessarily, but I know the smell.
Well, call 816-235-2888 with the smells that either entice you or freak you out in Kansas City. 816-235-2888. Do you recognize the World's of Fun smell we were discussing earlier?
Absolutely. The plastic bottle smell is actually, I think it's like sugar and plastic sort of melding together in the heat or something. It definitely has a special smell.
Mm.
And yes.
Changing smells, I mean, we've kind of touched on this, are about changing economies and changing communities, like changes in how we manage things like sewage. Can you talk to me about changing smells in Kansas City?
Smells have certainly changed in Kansas City. Historically, the West Bottoms, which was mentioned earlier, had a very distinct smell. Not just the cattle yards and meatpacking, but also all the steam locomotives that would have passed through there in the late 19th century.
So let's stick with the West Bottoms. This is the historic smell of the West Bottoms you're talking about. And on some level, I kind of remember aspects of that from going to the American Royal as a kid. Like, horses come with smells.
They do, absolutely. And that's the thing to consider in the historical side of it as well. Late 19th century, all transportation was horses. So every street smelled like a horse's product, if you know what I mean.
You know, actually, that's funny because I've... In learning some about the history of New York City, the history of the subway was actually inspired by the problem of, like, too much horse stuff on the streets. Like, we've got to get transportation off the street.
Absolutely. And a lot of it, too, was these carriages were actually carried. It was horse-drawn railway carriages. So it was like a streetcar, but powered by a horse.
So is Kansas City's streetcar, is that part of our history, too?
Probably. I think, like, if you look back in the past at cable cars, there would have been a power plant to power it, and then the smell of oil and grease. And
so the Folgers plant that we talked about before, that is this famous Kansas City smell, and it's within sensory memory of a lot, like most people who are listening to this program, I'm guessing. We have the big Folgers plant in one location from recent memory. But now when I think about coffee smells, I realize that that's been replaced by these tinier, like littler roasteries that are scattered through town now, where for just a small radius, not all of downtown, but you get that smell. You know,
exactly.
It does represent a changing economy.
I was thinking of that when I saw how many people commented about Folgers, and thinking about it, the Broadway Roasting Company. I work in Westport, so I hear, smell that constantly. And you know, even when people mention the brewing at Boulevard Brewing, you mm-hmm. smell it on a much smaller scale at McCoy's, for example,
yeah.
in Westport.
Jill, tell me about just a couple of your other smells in Kansas City that you find interesting.
The particularly interesting things for me when I go to any city is usually, first of all, the natural sense of the environment, the types of plants that grow there that are abundant in that region. And Kansas City especially, we don't have a whole lot of really aromatic, you know, flowers and things, but we do have very humid summers, and humidity allows scent molecules to be trapped and to travel to our scent glands much easier. So you can smell so much more with humidity, especially when it's combined with heat.
So our humidity helps us smell the not so fragrant flowers we do have.
Yeah, we actually have a lot more sensitivity to it because we have the ability to, the transfer is in the water vapor that, you know, can go inside our noses. So when you're in a really dry region, you actually can't smell very much, even if it is hot. And so in Kansas City, even though we have some maybe not so bright scents, we do have some really great honey locust trees that bloom in May, and those will stop you in your tracks if you walk underneath them. There's one at like in the crossroads, like just right in the middle of everything when you're just walking down Southwest Boulevard, and that one's really, you know, I love walking under those in the summer. And then there's lilac bushes that also bloom in May, and those are in a lot of areas, but they're more of a, you know, ornamental.
Nicholas, when you walk down boulevards, is there something about the boulevards themselves that helps you smell those smells more deeply?
A lot of times boulevards are situated in watersheds, so there's a lot more of that valley experience as you push through it or pass through it. One thing that's interesting about the changing scent or smells during different seasons in neighborhoods, I know that in West 39th Street, there's sort of a locally famous smell of the ginkgo trees.
Yeah, famous in the bad way.
In a very bad way.
No, go on.
Oh, and also in the River Market area, the Bradford pears, when they bloom, maybe somebody favors that smell. I don't.
Let's talk to Mark, who's calling us from the rail yards. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Love your show. Listen to it quite often.
Thank you.
Smells. Well, this one may be not the best of smells, but I work in the Kansas City Southern Railroad Yards, Kanoke, which is located in the east bottoms of Kansas City. And one of your guests mentioned a sulfur smell as you cross the river, Missouri River.
Yeah.
That could be what we here in the railroad yard refer to, sorry to say, the stink plant.
Stink line?
Stink plant.
Stink plant. Okay. Go on.
Okay. Let me give you an explanation. It's the sewer treatment plant that's located on the banks of the Blue River on the south side of the Missouri River in the east bottoms, right next to the Union Pacific Railroad Yard. It's kind of squashed in between Union Pacific Railroad Yard and Kansas City Southern Railroad Yard. And some mentioning summertime and the changing of the seasons and the smells. We feel like wearing a gas mask down here in the east bottoms of Kansas City during the summertime, especially when it gets very hot.
Well, so that sounds like a sort of a notorious smell.
Noxious, yes. Noxious smell, yeah.
I can hear clicking in the background. Is that something from the rail yard?
Well, I'm in a vehicle and I'm sitting between two railroad tracks and waiting for a railroad crew and to order for them to a safety feature is to have the blinkers, this warning lights on.
So I got it.
Hearing.
Well, thank you, Mark, for letting us know about what you all who work in the rail yards have to say about the sulfur smell, what you call the stink plant.
Yes, they're very noxious. But we also, you know, Kansas City is the coffee smells. I miss the Folgers in downtown Kansas City, the barbecue smells around our city. It's a very diversified, beautiful city. I love living here.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thanks. So toward the end of what Mark was saying, we heard about barbecue, which, of course, like, if we were to create a smell of Kansas City pride, that might be it.
Most likely. I think that is a big, you know, Kansas City historical thing that we've always done. So I don't know if I would want to smell like barbecue, but maybe some people are into that.
If you were going to create a scent of Kansas City, what would be included in it?
You know, I would have to stick with things that I like, and I think that would be more of the natural landscape. We have a lot of really great plants that grow around here, and we have a lot of green space, and I think sometimes we take that for granted. You know, we have yards, and people are mowing their yards, and we have grass scents all summer long going on, and you don't get that in a lot of cities. You know, so I would say it would be a lot of like prairie grasses and lawn grasses and just kind of mixed in with, yeah, little things that we've talked about, like maybe a little bit of smoky barbecue. I guess you can't really leave that out.
Nicholas, what would be in your scent of Kansas City? You are not a scent maker, but just imagining.
Well, one thing, and when it comes to the natural smell, I appreciate in Swope Park, the Blue River Glades that are off the Nature Center's trails. It's, to me, it's sort of an unadulterated, unique smell that doesn't exist elsewhere in the region.
It's hard to describe smells, but do you think you can describe this one?
That particular one, it smells sort of cave-like and like really, I guess you could say sharp and fresh, but I wouldn't use the word ancient necessarily, but the ecosystem has been consistent through time. One other particular smell for me, because the caller mentioned the East Bottoms. For me, my dad was a truck driver, and he would drive out of the East Bottoms by the General Mills plant. So diesel fuel always equates that.
Well, call in with your most intriguing or iconic Kansas City smells. We will accept smells from surrounding communities as well. The number to call is 816-235-2888. Also, smell mysteries. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we are talking about smells. Good smells, bad smells, mysterious smells at 816-235-2888. My guests this morning are Jill McKeever and Nicholas Bach. They are our smell expert and city design and history experts, respectively. Hi again, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
So we've got some calls from people who want to talk about particular smells in Kansas City. I want to turn to Keith in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Keith.
Hello.
What's your smell?
Well, my favorite smell is like in the springtime when going through Mission Hills, all the flowering plants. This was way back. Now it seems like all I smell are insecticides and fertilizer.
You smell other things more than the flowers?
Right, in the springtime, in Kansas City, Mission Hills, but even around my spring.
Our connection is
up all the time.
Yeah, our connection is kind of breaking up, but that gets us back to this idea that smells change and that's about more than smells.
Truthfully, one thing I thought about before this program was the smell in a certain neighborhood and how that changes over time. Speaking about barbecue, the municipal stadium was located only 4 blocks from Arthur Bryant's, and people attribute the popularity of Kansas City's barbecue to the fact that baseball announcers could smell that wafting up the hill. But eventually that baseball stadium with all of its associated smells, whatever it may be, was demolished and replaced with a community garden, which has a completely different aromatic character. And then eventually that was demolished and became a residential neighborhood, and that has its own sort of associated smells like baking or cars being worked on. I'm not sure, lawn mowing.
That's funny. And then there's also a baseball stadium smell that my thinking about what that is has to do, I'm sure, with the time period when I grew up or like where we sat or something. But it's beer spilled on pavement to me.
Yes.
Baseball stadium.
Yes. And maybe a little bit of a fountain smell if you're at Kaufman, I guess.
If you're sitting close enough to
right.
that fountain. Just thinking about, what do you have to say about just changing smells and that they say more, they tell us about more than just smell?
You know, I think another thing I think related to changing smells that's really interesting is that we have such drastically changing seasons here in addition. And that's something that I think keeps me wanting to like always live in Kansas City, because I visit other places and I'm just like, they don't have winter, they don't have summer like we do. And what happens is that during the winter we get a break, we get a chance to really miss the smells of summer, and then when it comes back it almost inspires us. And I mean, that's when I create the majority of my perfumes, is in, you know, the spring turning summer, because you just have this whole new world to like enter into again of scent that you didn't even realize was gone during the winter sometimes.
Does Kansas City have a thunderstorm smell in the summer?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And you know, rain scents are different depending on where you are and depending on how much, you know, soil you have and, you know, how much pavement you have and just the mixture of all of that that's going on in your city. And I think people, I think kind of across the board, everyone loves the smell of thunderstorms, and they have a very strong connection to it. And And I kind of wonder also if the region that you grew up in has the best storm smell to you, you know?
Yeah. Let's talk to John in Kansas City. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How about you?
Very good. Enjoying your show.
Thanks. What smell do you want to tell us about?
Well, when this topic came up, I just thought about, I love to go to the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, and I particularly like the Chinese Gallery. And there's just this wonderful kind of nutty aroma whenever I go. I think if you blindfolded me and I walked in there, I would know where I was. It's really interesting.
In that gallery, have you noticed that a lot of things are made out of a particular material that might explain it?
Well, if you go into particular sections of the Chinese gallery, particularly where the Kuan Yin statue is, I know that there's a lot of wood that was brought from China, and the ceiling and the walls are paneled in it, at least the ceiling is. I don't know if that's what accounts for it or not. I asked one of the docents one time if they cultivate that aroma or if it's just natural, and he said no, we don't do anything, it's just what it is.
Well, John, thank you for that call, and if no one in our studio has the answer, maybe we'll poke around for you after the show and see if we can find out exactly what accounts for the nutty smell in the Chinese gallery at the Nelson Atkins. Has anyone here noticed that smell?
You know, I can't remember now, like, what kind of woods that are used, but I would imagine rosewood or teak would be what those are made of, those artifacts, and those both have really beautiful scents to them, especially when they're carved. It allows that scent to just forever come out of it, and, I mean, cedarwood also has a great smell, but it's not as carvable.
Nicholas, as an architect, are there materials used in a lot of Kansas City buildings or in particular neighborhoods a lot that contribute to even some kind of like faint aroma?
I think when you start to look at iconic structures like the Nelson or even the Municipal Auditorium, those have a lot of bronzes or granites and other like limestone materials. And there's always this sort of like older, more permanent smell to those areas.
Smell. I love it.
Yeah, there's a sense
that it's...
The smell
of permanence.
Yes, a sense that this isn't a throwaway thing.
Let's talk to Greg in Midtown. Greg, what do you want to tell us about? Hello, Greg, are you there? Okay, I'm not hearing Greg, so we will get back to him. Let's talk to John. John in KCK. Hi, John. John, are you there? Okay, our callers aren't hearing us, but we will just continue talking amongst ourselves. Jill, tell me about another smell that intrigues you in Kansas City.
Oh, you know, I work across the street from YJ's, so that's like a daily thing. It's like one of those smells that, again, is great for the neighborhood because everyone knows you've been at YJ's today, haven't you?
Yeah. Someone commenting on social media referred to it as an investment.
Absolutely.
It's going to stay on you. Yeah. And everyone's going to know, like, you were at YJ's. It's a very distinct smell.
It is. Let's see. We have some tweets. Beth tweets us, my father worked for Santa Fe in Argentina as a diesel mechanic. Every time I drive over the rail yards and get the scent of diesel, it brings back great memories. So it sounds like, Nicholas, your memory that you shared earlier is like a pretty significant shared memory. And then we have Robert tweeting us saying, I remember growing up by the Wonder Bread Company on 28th and Troost. Wonderful smell. And that building on Troost, you know, that's being repurposed right now. I mean, history is changing and the smellscape with it.
Absolutely. And I think that type of smell that'll be associated with it in the future is very different as a, you know, residential building.
Jill, the idea of a shared smell experience, in your work, I would imagine that that's part of what you're working with. I mean, the scents that you create are very particular, but people recognizing them and having sort of broadly a predictable reaction, mm-hmm, seems like it would also have to be part of it.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things that everyone has, you know, kind of a similar, I don't know, like scent memory and a similar, yeah, there's a lot of things that we all go through in childhood and think that, you know, that we associate with positive things always. And then there's certain things that, you know, like you might be somewhere and you always associate that smell with something negative because something negative happened to you at that time, you know? So, you know, it's interesting what we consider positive and negative smells because it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with them smelling pleasant or not, which is interesting.
We have talked a lot about the West Bottoms. The East Bottoms, our conversation has revolved largely around diesel. Nicholas, do you have anything else to say about the East Bottoms?
Well, historically, it being the location of a brewery, there would have been a very distinct smell over 100 years ago. But also, along the lines of the World's a Fun smell, there would have been that sort of carnival smell of fried foods and
because of, what was it, there, Electric Park?
It was Electric Park number one was located there.
And so that yeasty smell that you would have had from that big brewery, I mean, it seems like we have sort of a parallel with the Folgers coffee, like the big plant that permeated an entire neighborhood, all of downtown, versus now smaller roasteries. Now there are these craft breweries popping up. Have you noticed a smell associated with them popping up as well?
Yes, at a smaller scale and more in a closer geographic range. One interesting thing about the breweries in the past, there were so many of them, and they were dispersed throughout the city, that would have been just another of the many robust smells of the past that kind of blended into something else that I can't even imagine.
I've read a blog post about the when the Folgers plant closed and a lot of people were upset about losing that smell. This blogger observed that a lot of businesses close that didn't get that same kind of hue and cry just because of the absence of a smell. Like the smell made all the difference in people's attachment to this local business. And some of the comments that I'm getting now are about places like Zoom, the soap shop, where they're making soap in the Crossroads, and people are developing an attachment now to this smaller scale smell, you know, something that you'd smell like within the block of that business. But it seems like that is a way that people become attached to a local business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Indigo Wild is just, so pepperminty and fresh, and that's a nice thing to walk by, and I think, yeah, that would be easy to get attached to. But it is one of those things. It has to do with your daily life. It has to do with, you know, this is where I am and this is what feels right because this is what it always smells like here.
Nicholas, do you have another favorite smell that we haven't talked about?
I have many different smells. One, I also appreciate how geography can change, or actually the smell can always associate itself with certain geography. So I recall Marco Polo and Jasper's at 75th and Warnell when I was a teenager. And now that's a Walgreens or CVS or something, but I still sort of associate that, I guess, cooked smell that was at that location with.
So you go through Waldo. Do you have like a phantom smell?
I guess that's what it would be. And I think a lot of people, based on their experiences, have that thing. One thing that really interests me is temporary smells like that are associated with a specific event. Like
what?
Like the flood of 1951 or...
Have you read or heard about a smell associated with that?
I have, and I don't have any accounts with me, but I imagine it wasn't a very positive smell with how much livestock perished in that.
Let's talk to...
And fires and other associated smells from that.
Let's talk to Dee in Lawrence. Hi, Dee.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. What do you want to share?
Well, I used to work at the BOP plant, which was the Buick Oldsmobile Pontiac plant in Kansas City, Kansas. And we would go to work real early in the morning and go by the Colgate Palmolive plant. And the smell of the soap was so strong. And actually, it smelled very good.
Do you still smell that when you go by that same location now?
No, I don't. I don't think they're there any longer, as far as I know.
But in your imagination, you can still smell it?
Oh, yeah. But then I would get to the BOP plant, and across the parking lot was a fiberglass plant that was so strong, and the mist, it had a mist coming off of the plant and would just settle all over the cars and everything. But it was such a strong fiberglass smell.
Wow, Dee, thank you so much. We are out of time, but thanks to all of our callers, and thanks to Jill McKeever and Nicholas Bach for anchoring this smell odyssey.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Jill is a local fragrance maker. Her line is Four Strange Women, and Nicholas is an architect. He writes about history, design, and place for Squeezebox KC. You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. Be sure and check out our chat with Missouri engineer, who is headed off to NASA. She raps about the quadratic equation. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.